Welcome to This Is Money podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm your host, Georgie Frost, and alongside me today is editor Simon Lambert. And coming up, a major victory for This Is Money in the fight against online fraud, as Britain's biggest banks trial a new system to trace stolen money. Is the end nigh for scammers? Also, as we come up to peak seasonal shopping madness, now is a busy time for credit card applications, but have we just seen the most generous sign-up bonus in years? No, it's not a tranquilizer, so what is vanadium and why is it such a hot topic for investors? And as London-focused estate agents increasingly feel the impact of a slowdown, Simon asks, rather contrarily, does the 18-year property cycle predict the next move for house prices is a boom? Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I. For a gift your little ones will appreciate even when they're not so little. Give them premium bonds at nsandi.com.
But first, This Is Money is famous for its campaigning work on behalf of readers. Most recently, as you will have heard in our podcast, it was parking sharks and parents losing out on state pensions. But back in 2016, Simon and the team launched their Stop the Bank Scammers campaign. And this week, we got something of a victory for the thousands tricked into transferring cash online to fraudsters. Britain's biggest banks announced this week that they're trialling a new system which allows them to see where this money ends up. They can therefore act quickly to freeze it, so victims should have a far greater chance of getting it back. But it doesn't stop there, though. Banks are also working with telecoms giants on a new system to stop scam text messages getting through, and we're expecting new rules to come in early next year that will spell out exactly what banks have to do to help prevent customers falling victim. So, Simon, just outline the general issue of online fraud and how big it is.
In the old days, if you wanted to con someone, you used to have to go around and perhaps speak to them, put some real work in talking to them on the phone. But then you'd need to get them to hand over the money to you. And that was quite difficult because it did involve an element of you needed to go do some work, some personal touch kind of things. Nowadays, you could do it over the internet. You don't even need to leave the comfort of your bedroom. People will call people up and then try and get them to transfer money online. Very easy. Much easier than trying to get someone to meet you and give you a bag load of cash or something like that.
Who's doing this? People in their bedrooms, is it?
No, I think what we're seeing
organized
is...
Organised gangs?
This is organised crime. What we hear from the police and from experts is that there is a level of organisation going on here. It's not just people waking up one morning and thinking, do you know what, I'm just going to con people from the comfort of my bedroom. So that was slightly misleading there. There will be people working on their own, but it's an organised crime, and it may be a loosely organised crime. So it may be people going onto the dark web, for example, buying people's bank details or buying people's personal details that they can, and then using them to apply the pressure points to people to then try and get their money off them. Now, we've been campaigning on this since 2014, and that came out the back of a number of investigations that we did where we were contacted by people who had been ripped off. And the common thread running through these was that they had been phoned up, they had been convinced in some way that they needed to transfer money and they needed to transfer money fast, and often the ruse used to do this was to tell people that their account had been compromised in some way and that the person calling was from the bank and that they needed to transfer their money to a safe account. They were managing to convince people that they were calling from the bank. There was a trick that was often being pulled where they would say, call us back. The person would call them back, but they would stay on the line because they'd phone on the landline. And so they'd manage to stay on the line. They'd call back, they'd answer it, pretending they were the bank, take people through security, that kind of thing. Obviously, the pressure element of your account's been compromised, you need to move the money now, fraudsters are going to take the money otherwise. People would manage to be convinced. They would transfer the money, off it would go into another account. They would eventually then realise that actually that they had been defrauded or conned. They would go to the bank, they would go to the police. And the banks were, in a sense, trying to wash their hands of this because they were arguing that unlike the situation where someone steals your bank card or in some way manages to compromise your account and they've got through the bank systems, the banks were arguing that it was your fault because you had transferred the money.
Like
you,
giving you'd someone been your conned PIN and almost. You transferred like the money. You've
yeah.
done it. It's your fault.
Exactly.
You've given over these details.
So if someone manages to somehow clone your bank card, go on a spending spree, if they don't have your PIN number, they've stolen your card or they've cloned it or whatever, then as long as they don't have your PIN number, then it's not your fault. The bank should refund you. As long as you haven't done anything negligent. The banks were basically arguing that people had done something negligent here. So we investigated a series of these. In many cases, we managed to secure a victory for people.
Give us some of the worst examples or the damage that you've seen, because there's two elements to this. One, you've lost money, but two, emotionally.
We had people who had been tricked into transferring tens of thousands of pounds. In some instances, I believe that it was £100,000 or more. Elderly people who had been tricked into transferring their life savings. We had a number of cases involving farmers who had just had their EU payments into their accounts and they'd been tricked into transferring that money. Now, someone knew that they were about to get a large payment. We had a business, actually, that risked going out of business, and that was, I think, a couple of £100,000. So it was affecting a wide range of people. Yeah. And then we had people who were just conned into transferring a few £1,000s. So you've got a really wide-ranging scenario there. We called for a number of things in our campaign, one of which is that we felt that the banks weren't doing enough to warn people. Banks knew that this was a problem, but they weren't doing enough to warn people. And we wanted them to warn people. A victory was secured in that now, if you go onto your internet banking, a lot of those banks now do put up a warning that says things like, we will never ask you to transfer money to a safe account, or things you should do to check. So, for example, someone calls you on your landline, tells you your account's been compromised, call us back. The old trick was people would get the number off the back of their bank card and call them back, thinking, oh, that's safe. Of course, the person stayed on the line. So someone calls you on your landline, hang up your landline, then call your bank back on the number on the back of the card on your mobile.
And it may be a longer process. You may have to type in all your details. It may be a long way of doing it, but it is so worth it.
Again, another step that I would highly recommend. Anybody puts you in that kind of position, you find out something like that, your bank calls you up and you're a bit suspicious. Now, the problem is my bank has called me up about fraud before and I was seriously suspicious as to whether it was the bank, and it was the bank. But anybody calls you up and you're a bit suspicious, phone a friend.
But there's also incidences, not just on the phone. We've spoken a lot in the past on the podcast about people who were transferring money via the internet to, say, a builder. And then they would email you back and say, oh, the details have changed. And you would send that money through. And lo and behold, the real builder would call you and go, where's my money? And the banks were saying, equally, you've given over the wrong details.
Solicitors, house deposits.
Yes.
We've had that as well. Essentially, their whole home buying thing has been torpedoed because the email has been hacked in some way, or an email has been sent that manages to convince people that it's from them. It's the whole hang up the phone, put the phone down, call them back on another phone, call the solicitor up, call the builder up, have your bank details changed.
Or transfer a pound is one of the things that a lot of people say, a very small sum of money.
And then contact the builder and say, have you got the pound I just transferred you? Because this is the element that the fraudsters manage to take advantage of, is that people don't check. It can be quite difficult to check sometimes, but the easiest way to check is to contact that person in a way that you know is guaranteed to be that person.
Yeah.
And then check in that sense. But the one thing that we always said that we thought was a problem and that we wanted the banks to do is, obviously, this may not be the bank's fault, but what is facilitating this is the banking system, the modern-day banking system.
The scammer must have a bank account, though, right, for this money to go into. So why couldn't they in the past have traced where that went?
The money has to go somewhere. Now, our colleagues on Moneymail have also started a campaign recently on this, and there is a victory here for both of our campaigns in that Britain's biggest banks are trialling a new system that enables them to trace stolen money. So typically, someone's tricked into transferring cash to a fraudster. The banks say the problem is the money goes from your account to another account that the fraudster's got, and then it bounces and just goes off to lots of different accounts. And that it's very hard for them to keep track of where it goes. The banking system's also not set up for them to start trying to claw that money back from other bank accounts. The new system allows the banks to see where the money ends up and then act quickly to freeze it. You'd think that would have been done years ago.
That's exactly what I was thinking. Why did it take so long?
What I still don't understand, even when I'm told by the banks of this problem where you transfer your money from your account account A to account B, where it then bounces off into accounts C, D, E, F, G, all the letters of the alphabet and so on. Someone's still controlling account B.
Mm.
Why follow the money, as the old saying goes. Start at account B. And if you can start at account B, because it has to have hit that account and then bounced into all these other accounts. So you must be able to pinpoint the owner of account B and go after them to try and work it out. The problem is really difficult if you've been defrauded to try and work out whether it's being investigated properly by the police and or who's even investigating it.
That's a good question. Who is investigating it? Because a lot of people say they've asked the police and they've really done not a lot about it.
Well, the suspicion is that nobody's investigating it properly.
Oh, okay.
The suspicion is that the police are, as we know, under-resourced, struggling to keep track of all the crimes that they're meant to be investigating, that there are dedicated police officers who investigate this kind of stuff, but there's just not enough of them. That the problem is because you're dealing with Bank 1, Bank 2, Bank 3, Bank 4, they're not really communicating with each other properly. There was the sort of action fraud organisation thing that nobody was really convinced about. I mean, I guess the problem is in order to follow all of this stuff, it requires an element of forensic investigation.
So then what's this new system and how optimistic are you that it's actually going to work and it means that people have a far greater chance of getting their money back?
Okay, so I would not imagine that this is going to solve the problem instantly. And we don't really have that much information on exactly how this system is going to work. However, what I would say is that it is a major step in the right direction. What it means is that the banks are taking very seriously now this thing where it bounces from lots of different accounts to another. And banks logged 34,128 cases of so-called push payment fraud in the year to July, almost 200 a day.
34,000?
Yeah. Just £31 million of the stolen £145 million was returned to customers, according to trade body UK Finance. Money Mail, in their campaign, had a six-point plan. Number one was follow the money. Criminals bounce the stolen money.
Which, so the banks so far, so good system. On that one. Yeah, tick.
So what they're doing is they are using the information provided by the Faster Payments Service, which logs all payments made by banks, to trace where the money went, even if it was split into smaller sums. A spokesman for payment services provider PayUK says the information gathered has already been used by banks to disrupt criminals by identifying the mule accounts so they can be blocked, the money frozen, and further investigated. Doesn't mean people are guaranteed to get their money back.
No.
The other one is make the banks accountable.
So this is the six-point plan.
Six-point plan, yeah.
Your website, you look at what you've achieved so far and what still needs to be done.
Point number two, make banks accountable. If they've not done enough to stop fraudsters opening accounts they use to store stolen funds, for example, if the scammers have used a fake ID or something like that, the banks must be responsible for the losses and refund the money.
And we're getting new rules in next year. Does that cover that part off?
A draft code of conduct published in September said that in the event banks do not meet their responsibilities, they should refund victims unless they have good reasons not to, such as the customer failing to take reasonable care. I mean, they're going to try and wriggle out of it, aren't they? But it's in the right direction.
Yeah.
Set up fraud hotlines. All banks must have a dedicated fraud hotline. Victims can call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Most major banks do have a 24-hour fraud telephone line. TSBs, however, only works from 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. during the week and 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. at weekends. But TSB says you can still use its out-of-hours service if you need to freeze your card. I had a problem the other day where I was contacted by my bank, First Direct, about a suspicious payment. And normally with First Direct, you're talking to someone in the UK. Actually, when you talk to their fraud department, they share their fraud department with their parent bank, HSBC.
I was going to say, because I had got that phone call yesterday.
Yeah, I ended up talking to a guy in India, and look, he wasn't really making a lot of sense. He asked me about this payment on my account, and I hadn't made it. And then he asked me about another payment on my account 3 or 4 weeks earlier. And I said, well, no, I didn't make that payment either, but it hasn't shown up in my statement.
Yeah.
And he's like, okay, well, that's okay then. And I said, well, why didn't you contact me about it at the time?
Yeah.
He said, well, I'm asking you about it now. And I said, yeah, but why didn't you ask me about it then? He said, because we flagged it and we didn't make the payment. And I said, but if someone tried to make a payment on my account and you didn't make it, why didn't you contact me? Is this common? And he said, well, no, we're contacting you because of this one now. And we just went round in circles for about 30 minutes. And he told me that the one that had been suspicious most recently was a Domino's one. And apparently there were lots of fraudulent transactions going on for Domino's. And I did get in contact with First Direct to try and find out about this. And I never heard anything back from them. But I found it to be a deeply... I find First Direct to be a very satisfying bank to bank with. I found my experience talking to their fraud people to be a deeply unsatisfying experience.
So I take a sharp intake of breath there, just because it sounds very similar to mine. And I assume, as you said, it shares with HSBC. So we probably spoke to the same fraud department. And I had a very similar experience where actually both of the transactions were genuine. One was of the day, i.e. yesterday, and one was a few days before. And they flagged that one up, but allowed it to go through. And I said, well, one, both were legitimate, but if you had concerns, why didn't you just call me then? I did go through the proper processes where they sent me a text message and then I actually called the number separately from a different number, etc. But that, I agree with you, it was troubling.
Yeah, I must admit that even though I'd called them up and I'd verified the number and I'd checked the number they'd given me, because they left me an answer phone message to call them, and I called them up and I'd verified the number, there's a fraud team. Halfway through talking to this guy, I started questioning whether I was actually talking to someone from their fraud team and whether this was genuine. And so I did actually end up hanging up and then calling the bank back. It was a very unsettling experience. I knew there was no money missing, but then it was a question of, like, how many of these transactions are you stopping that I never even hear about?
Yeah. And in my case, how many are you allowing to go through that you now question as to whether it's legitimate? It's concerning on lots of different levels. So lots more absolutely has to get done here. Where else have we got to go? I think we've got up to point three, haven't we? There's still a long way to go.
So phone firms need to help telecom providers. So there's this smishing,
right?
Smishing, which is where people manage to get into your text message stream from the bank. We need that to stop. The banks are now meant to be working more closely with them. Watchdogs with teeth. We need basically payment systems regulators to draw up clear rules on exactly when banks should refund fraud victims. It's all a bit woolly. Police these rules strictly. Financial ombudsmen should be given more power to investigate fraud, regardless of who the customer banks with. And then finally, compensate victims. A total of 130 million is sitting in frozen accounts once used by criminals. With a simple change in the law, it could be used to compensate victims. So far, the government has refused to refund this money to victims, and banks have said they can't do it without changing the rules. A Treasury spokesman said, "We set up the payment systems regulator to ensure people can move their money with confidence, but more must be done to help victims of push payment scams. That's why we back the regulator establishing a group of consumer and industry representatives to look at how best to reimburse victims." All I will say is we have been campaigning on this since 2014. We have been investigating these cases since at least 2 years before that. It is now nearly the end of 2018. Why do we have to wait so long for all of these things to get fixed? We go round and round in circles with officials and regulators and banks and codes of conduct and this organisation and that organisation. Meanwhile, people are getting ripped off.
Yeah.
To the tune of 200 people a day, apparently.
That figure is just astonishing. If you have been a victim of online fraud or you would like us to investigate anything, please do get in contact with your experience. But I'm not actually going to drop the C-bomb. Not yet, anyway, but you know it's coming. Lots of people choose to spread the cost of this rather expensive time of year with a zero purchase credit card. That's where you pay no interest for up to 30 months, so long as, of course, you make the repayments and you can afford it. Up to 20% this time last year compared to the rest of November and December, according to GoCompare. Now, why? Well, that's probably because it's one of the last weeks that you're able to apply for a credit card and get it in time for Black Friday. Yes, that is coming even before we get to the other festive shopping experience. But there are other tempting options to be had if you are so in the market for a new credit card. One from Virgin Money is being called the most generous sign-up bonus in the last few years. But a return trip to New York? Really? Well, before you tell us more about this specific one, reward cards generally, because when we talk about credit cards, you tend to talk about the zero purchase or the balance transfer, moving debt around. But this is something a little bit different.
Yes. Now, I must admit, I've always been fairly unconvinced by the whole rewards system. I'm a man who has on more than one occasion announced that life is too short for cashback, and I count things like club card points and all the other stuff within that. Essentially, you're getting a little bit of money back from your spending with those things because someone's taking your data and using it to, you know, in some way market stuff to you and try and convince you to sell more. That's what the whole club card thing was built upon, you know. And you do get free stuff. But reward credit cards are an interesting one. There are quite a few people who would be considered to be pretty savvy with their money who use them and do actually manage to get rewarded for their spending. Now, one of the things that you have to question, obviously, is why do reward credit cards exist in the first place? Why did the credit card industry invent this?
Because it's all for you.
Yeah.
It's gifting you for your loyalty. No? No, Simon?
No.
No?
Oh. Well, I like to think that the credit card industry is run by a small band of altruists. they're like somewhere at the top of it, there's a group of them, and they all meet up once a year. They roll their trouser legs up and they meet in secret. And they're like the Illuminati.
I was thinking Charlie and the Chocolate Factory kind of thing, but no.
Yeah, they're like the Illuminati, but unlike the Illuminati, they're not convinced that they need world domination. What they want to do is just spread the love with rewards to help you out.
Mm. That's not the case, though.
No, unfortunately, they're probably more like the Illuminati because what they want you to do is spend more money on your credit card. World domination of credit cards. Basically, the idea behind this is to get you to spend more money. And the same thing with the whole balance transfer, purchase card, 0% kind of thing. Why do people offer you 0%? Because there's enough people who get caught out by it.
Yeah.
They don't pay the balance off in time. They move on to the much higher rate and they can make a profit from it. But if you are savvy enough to spend the money on the card and then pay the money off so that you don't end up paying any interest or charges, which that's the problem, that interest and charges eats into those rewards and can very easily take them away, then you can actually do quite well off these. Now, they're not as generous as they used to be, the good old days of earning bundles of air miles and things like that, but some of them are pretty good. And Virgin has just come out with a new one, Virgin Atlantic Rewards Card. Those applying for it can earn up to 10,000 Flying Club rewards miles with the airline, while its premium Rewards Plus card offers an even more generous 25,000 free miles. That's enough to get you return flights to Hong Kong, New York, or the Caribbean and back. Now, there's a guy we know, we speak to, called Rob Burgess. He's the editor of a frequent flyer website called Head for Points. And he says this is the most generous sign-up bonus seen in the last few years. The offer is for new customers opening a credit card before the 14th of December 2018. If you already have one of the cards, you can still qualify as a new customer as long as you're applying for the other one of the two cards on offer and you signed up more than 6 months ago. Now, one of the advantages is the Virgin Atlantic account comes with a MasterCard. That's more widely accepted than its biggest rival, the BA American Express card. And as well as on Virgin Atlantic flights, you can use the points on Eurostar, Delta and Singapore Airlines, Air New Zealand, Jet Airways, Air China, ANA, Scandinavian Airlines and Hawaiian Airlines. Now, what you need to do is obviously you need to spend some money on it. So the Virgin Atlantic Rewards card offers 5,000 Flying Club miles after your first purchase within 3 months. If you spend £1,000 within that time, it will hand over an extra 5,000 miles. In addition, after a £20,000 spend, that's a lot of money, you get a free companion ticket or premium upgrade. You get 0.7 points per £1 spent on the card or 1.25 per £1 spent on Virgin Holidays or Virgin Atlantic flights. APR, 22.9%. So make sure you pay the balance off each month. So a spending example in our article here by Emma Gunn is a £1,000 monthly spend would earn you 9,000 miles per year or 19,000 in the first year, including the bonus. That's just shy of the 20,000 needed to get a return to New York. So you'll probably have to get them to drop you off from the plane somewhere over the Atlantic.
Grand a month. Yeah.
Grand a month. Yeah, it's a lot of money. But then if you put all of your spending on it and then paid it off, and this is the trick some people do, if they're super savvy and super convinced that they're responsible enough to pay their balance off every month, is they do all of their household spending on it and then they pay it off each month. Now, obviously, you've got to bear in mind that there's so many people who get caught out by that.
Mm-hmm. And with that APR as well, though.
Yeah, and with that APR, it's going to cost you a small fortune if you don't pay it off. The Virgin Atlantic Rewards Plus card offers a higher earning potential, but it comes with an annual fee of £160. You get 15,000 miles for your first spend within 90 days, plus an extra 10,000 with a 1,500 outlay. And after a £10,000 spend, you get a companion ticket or a seat upgrade to premium class. Again, a lot of money. So everyday spending gets you 1.5 miles per pound and so on. Now, what you need to think about here is that if you take this card out, right, it's going to cost you £160 annual fee, but you get 15,000 miles for your first spend within 90 days, plus an extra 10,000 with a 1,500 outlay. Now, that's probably pretty achievable, especially if you're going to be going and buying maybe a big Christmas spend.
Yeah.
Maybe you're about to book a holiday for the family or something like that. And that 25,000 miles is enough to get you your flight to New York and back. I mean, how much is a return flight to New York as well? You've got to bear that in mind. But you're probably going to end up £300 or £400 if you take away that £160 fee.
It depends on how you use these things. Look, if you're someone that's going to be beneficial to, then great. But it doesn't sound to me, I mean, certainly for the way I spend, it wouldn't be relevant to me. As much as I would love to go to New York, there are other things that I would want than that. And reward card, credit cards generally, No,
I'm not convinced either. And I hope I added enough caveats
into
that description.
But it's like any card, you need to work out if it's right for you.
So I have two children.
Mm-hmm.
As a family of four, we go on holiday a couple of times a year. That costs quite a lot of money.
Yeah.
Flights for a family of four, especially when you've got kids at school, are fiendishly expensive. Then there's things like usually we'll stay in an apartment or something, but that costs, you know, X amount to rent. Quite often, sometimes we've gone on holiday with family. I'll end up booking flights for the whole family and then getting the money back off them. I paid for a villa. We went on holiday with my wife's sister and her husband and the kids. So I paid for the villa and got the money back off them. We split the cost. If you suddenly start thinking about those big spends that you make, and I would say those are probably the biggest spends. Otherwise, there might be something big you buy for the house, like a sofa or something like that. That's pretty sizable. And I did think this, or I have thought this a number of times over the past year. Maybe I should get one of these cards and do that, because quite often I am actually just putting it onto a credit card just because of the extra protection you get. I'm not earning anything for that. I'm not paying any interest because I pay the bill off quickly. And I've also got a permanent low rate credit card. The rate's like 6.8%. Means if you don't pay it off immediately, you don't need to worry too much about it because it's not that much interest. But maybe I should get one of these cards, because actually, if you are going to spend the money and you could just get, for example, enough miles to get a free flight to New York or back, maybe you should just take that. And the other one where I think this might be worthwhile, the days of the company credit card are long gone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it used to be the company gave you a credit card and then the company just paid the bill. Nowadays, a lot of people are expected to put their spending for the company onto their own credit card or their own bank account and then pay it off. And the way most people deal with that is they take out a separate credit card and they use that for their expenses, because then they're not mingling it with their household expenses, and then they claim the money back off the company and do it. So if you're the kind of person who has to travel for business, who has to take people out for business and then claim it back, you could take out one of these cards and you could start earning yourself some rewards for doing so.
Just want to ask you one final thing on this point before we move on, because I mentioned Black Friday there. I heard some great news that apparently loads of people aren't getting involved. Could it be? Could it be true? Could we finally get rid of it?
No, Black Friday, apparently not a hit with the retailers. They have decided that it is more of a hindrance than a help.
Yes.
Well, don't get your hopes up too much, Georgie. I mean, it's still going to be all across the high street. There's lots of shops that aren't going to do it. And one of the reasons that they gave, beyond the fact that it's A,
rubbish,
annoying, B, promotional, and just encourages a load of people to buy a load of stuff before Christmas, and then they sit on their hands and refuse to buy anything until just before Christmas, when they know the shops will be forced into having sales.
It just brings spending forward.
Basically, it just means that nobody buys anything between the start of December and about December the 16th, when the shops fold and then bring their sales. And it's like, okay, let's buy our stuff now. No, one of the reasons is apparently due to the volume of stuff being bought online and then taken back. And a lot of retailers lose money on the delivery costs online. Even if they charge you for delivery, they end up still paying more than that. And then once you take into account the returns thing, they lose even more money. So they've decided it's not worth it.
Well, here's hoping.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, giving you the chance every month to win up to £1 million tax-free.
Now, we often talk about interesting investments, wine, classic cars, art, stamps. But what about vanadium? It's a metal, and its price has soared by 960% in 2 years. Now, Simon, you've had a reader get in contact asking, is this a potential investment or just a very risky punt? So firstly, vanadium. Not Valium, as I first read that. Vanadium. What is it? Was it useful?
Vanadium. An obscure silvery grey metal, mostly used as a steel hardener, but has more recently, and I think this is probably the key here, become a key component in batteries that can store renewable energies like solar and wind, known as VRBs. The metal has benefited from a number of tailwinds, which has seen its price per kilogram soar by 960% from $13.25 to $140.50 over 2 years, and that was to the 4th of November 2018. To put this into context, the prices of precious metals, gold, silver and platinum, grew 10%, 30% and 20% over the same period. Now, vanadium, silvery grey metal, rarely exists as a free element in nature, but can be found in about 65 different minerals and fossil fuel deposits like oil. China and Russia control the vast majority of known vanadium deposits in the world. And it might look unimpressive, but it's quite valuable, particularly in manufacturing, due to its malleable, ductile and corrosion-resistant qualities. And it's used in a range of economic purposes, making titanium and chemicals, but its ability to make steel stronger and its use in batteries to store renewable energy is what has caught the eye of many investors. No, I didn't learn all of that. I am reading that from our article. Now, the reason why we thought we'd better do something on this is because anything that has risen 960% in 2 years is exactly the kind of thing that you might start to get those shady phone calls or emails about from someone telling you why you must invest in vanadium now. What I would say is, if anybody calls you up and offers you a vanadium investment, if anyone calls you up and offers you any investment, it's just put the phone down.
Yeah.
Reputable companies don't phone people up and offer them investments over the phone out of the blue. They don't cold call you. Reputable investment firms don't cold call you. And if any reputable investment firms are actually in the process of cold calling people and are listening to this and want to get in touch and correct us, I would say just stop cold calling people.
Yeah, exactly.
They don't send you emails out of the blue offering you a great vanadium investment and all these other things. So just don't buy into it. It doesn't matter what company they're talking about, what great offer they've got, however much money they say that you can make. Just don't do it. If you do think that this sounds like the kind of thing that you might want to invest in, then there are a number of companies involved in it. The problem is, how are you going to assess that company? How do you know the strength of that company? Also, companies that are involved in metals, commodities, etc., can be extremely volatile. So if you do want to invest in one of them, then I would advise you to invest only a very small part of your portfolio and be prepared for it to ride a complete roller coaster line on the price.
Okay. Well, let's turn our attention to the investor staple, shall we? Property. But it's not looked so rosy of late across London and the South East particularly, with estate agents focusing their business in this region, particularly coming under pressure since the Brexit vote triggered a considerable slowdown. Those who are able to are staying put to see whether prices will fall further after the UK leaves the EU. Now, Foxtons have closed down 6 of their branches over the summer and reported a loss in the first half of this year, blaming fewer transactions. Now, Simon, we've spoken about this on the show over the past years, and I could never get it into my head. I walked down the high street and I'd see these really large, sort of almost bar-style premises popping up all over the shop. I just couldn't work out, how sustainable is that really going to be? Especially, and I thought more about the rise of online estate agents as opposed to Brexit. It seems, can we call it the bubbles burst for companies like that?
Yes. Well, I think times are changing. So why do those big coffee bar style boutique estate agents with the lights on and everything looking fancy offices exist? Mm. Do they exist to sell people properties? They've got lots of pictures of properties in the window that you can buy, and there's brochures and glossy
Not
stuff
that
inside.
Many.
No.
It's glass and nice chairs from wherever. And
so someone
fridges.
Who works in the property industry years ago explained to me, and this was back when you used to get more of the traditional advertising in the local newspapers, the stuff that you still get in the glossy property supplements, so for example the Sunday Times one, the Telegraph and so on, estate agents don't put adverts in those supplements. They didn't used to put adverts or go for the big page adverts in the local newspaper or even have these really fancy looking branches and the stuff in the window necessarily to sell people houses. They have them to get people to list houses with them. So people who are going to sell their property go, ooh, yeah, they look good. They look impressive. That's the kind of place I want to sell my house.
Yeah.
It's faux show. Obviously, that is expensive. And the internet has changed the game slightly because people now tend to just look online for their properties. So they're definitely not there to sell the properties anymore. They're definitely there to try and get the sellers in to list their properties with them. But it's very expensive to run. And when the property market takes a downturn and you see transactions fall, and transactions in London are down about 25% over the past 2 years, and it's obviously estate agents make their money when they sell homes, not just by putting them in their window and listing them. And if they're not selling so many homes, it's not even really that important what's happening to house prices. They just don't have the same volume coming into their books, and times start to be tight. So this has bitten Foxton's hard as one of the prime examples of a London centric.
Are there others, or is it just
yeah
there?
Yeah, there's no, the others are suffering, but others are maybe a bit more diversified, a bit less focused on London, spend a little bit less money on fancy branches and things like that, or have invested themselves into some form of online operation, and they're seeing their revenue fall and finding that they're being chopped at the knees, kind of thing. So they've had to close 6 branches, basically, Foxtons have said. Now,
I think it's extraordinary no one saw that coming, though, because I would never suggest that I'm anywhere near an expert at anything, literally anything, but it's so obvious. It was so glaringly obvious.
It is, because really you only have to look at the cautionary tale of an estate agent called Foxtons to see where it happened before. So famously, the founder of Foxtons, John Hunt, got out just before the financial crisis. He sold the company for a lot of money, made a lot of money from it, and then Foxtons really...
Good timing.
Obviously, when you had the post-financial crisis crash, the newly sold Foxtons really, really struggled. And then it picked itself up, dusted itself down as the London property market boomed again, but now the London property market has been sunk. The problem that they also face coming down the line, and they're very wary of, is this tenants' fees ban. It's like a balancing act. So when the sales market does really well, the rental market doesn't tend to do so well. And when the sales market does badly, the rental market tends to do better. Mm. Now, sales is obviously the thing that everybody focuses on, but the rental market is a really nice, steady stream of income for estate agents, because they just keep picking up the commission on renting out properties, and people tend to just keep renting properties. You know, the tenants might change, for example, but it's a fairly stable market. But they've been earning lots and lots of extra, what Ryanair would call ancillary revenues, the stuff it makes from flogging your priority boarding and stuff like that. They've been earning lots of extra money from charging tenants extra stuff that really they're already charging the landlords for. You decide to stay on after your initial 6-month period and they redo you a contract, but that costs you an extra couple of hundred quid, that kind of thing. Now, that kind of stuff is meant to be being banned. It's proceeding extremely slowly through a rather disrupted parliament at the moment, but it is meant to be coming in, and it's going to eat into the revenues of these companies quite substantially. So they've got that coming up on the horizon as well.
All right, so relatively troubled times, and let's be honest, the political situation, as you delicately alluded to there, with the government, is not so stable. So taking all this on board, we've got, you know, Brexit on the horizon. An interesting subject to your latest column, I thought, Simon. Rather than the gloom and doom predictions of house price crashes, etc., etc., you are asking, are house prices preparing to go on something of a run?
Huh? Yes. Ever the contrarian.
No, indeed.
I've now decided to be contrarian to my own long-held view that houses are massively overpriced,
yes,
and are due some form of seriously big fall, because we basically disrupted the boom and bust cycle, this cycle of creative destruction after the financial crisis with super low interest rates and then loads of cheap money thrown at the housing market, and then the whole funding for lending, throw a load of cheap money at the banks and get it to lend it out, help to buy, let's just subsidise people buying new build houses by lobbing them interest-free cash for 5 years, that we might be causing ourselves huge problems coming down the line. So yeah, then I went and wrote an article saying our house price is about to go on something of a run. So what on earth's going on here?
Yeah, don't know.
Exactly. Well, firstly, basically, I was reading something quite interesting the other day, and I was led to this by the weekend reading post of the blog Munnovator, which we have mentioned before, and it flagged up a post from a blog called My Deliberate Life, and which was talking about the 18-year property cycle theory of a man called Fred Harrison. Now, this rang a bell. It's like, I kind of remember that. So I went digging through the archives, otherwise known as Googling Fred Harrison, yep. This Is Money.
Yep.
And yes, of course, it rang a bell because we'd written about this guy before and we had actually run a column from him in 2008, I think it was, because he had forecast in his 2005 book, Boom Bust, that another housing slump would occur in 2007/2008. And if you remember rightly, a housing slump occurred in 2007/2008. This is based on the theory of the 18-year property cycle, that the market moves from boom to bust over 18 years.
Seems very precise, 18. Can they just round it up to 20? It sounds nicer. No,
but it's 18. Okay, 18 is important. Okay. But you've got to bear in mind that it doesn't... he's not suggesting it's literally... start here,
right, exactly.
End there. You know, these things, they sometimes they go longer, sometimes they go shorter. But so, yeah, maybe he could have rounded up to 20. But then 18 was the number he focuses on. Now, it suggests that house prices crash every 18 years. And his theory identified slumps in 1953/4, 1971/2, 1989/90, and then forecast the next one in 2007/8. So he got that bit right, didn't he? The thing to notice is that actually if you look back on the house price chart, some of those busts don't even look that big because obviously house prices have risen so much that you're looking back and it looks like a small dip. But at the time, it was very painful. So the one in the early 90s doesn't even look that bad. But actually, that was probably the worst in living memory people have suffered through. The one in the mid-70s was actually didn't really even see nominal prices fall, but inflation, actual inflation, was so high that even if house prices stayed the same, they dropped 10% in a year in real terms. So if you look at the housing market and you drill into it, you can kind of see this 18-year cycle. And the way that it's meant to work is that the crash happens. The market takes 4 or 5 years to recover. So that's a kind of slow recovery. Then it has steady growth for 6 or 7 years. Then it's hit by a small 1 or 2 year correction. And following that, it booms for another 5 to 6 years before the next crash arrives again. I got my spreadsheet out and I tried to map this one out. And it roughly fits with what we've seen in the property market at the moment, okay? You have to squish the time frames a little bit. And we've, as I said, we've probably...
It doesn't sound very scientific, Simon. It sort of roughly fits. You have to squish things
about.
Well,
that's how cycles work. I mean, there's an observable cycle, the business cycle. So, the recession cycle and things like that. That you can see these patterns. So why did you even see this? Why do these patterns happen? It's human nature. It's just human behaviour. It's herd mentality. Basically, you start at the point where something's too expensive and the price crashes. So then it slowly recovers because who wants to buy that? That was so last year. That thing was way overpriced. I'm not buying that. Or people are suffering financially, particularly if it's something like house prices that severely affects the economy. People's fingers were burnt. Eventually, it becomes so cheap that people start to buy again. And then people start to hear that people are making money on it. Or people start to hear that it's cheap, so they start buying it. And then the price starts to go up. So then you get this pause element where everyone goes, oh, hang on a minute, this is a bit expensive now, or something happens that sort of pauses it, and then people take a step back, and then you get the final run-up, you get that exuberance, the euphoria, the you just can't not make money from it, or you have to buy it now because it's only going to get more expensive. I've got to buy this house, because if I don't buy this house, this house will cost £50,000 more next year, and then you hit the top, and then unfortunately the people who bought in at the end really, really suffer. So you can map this to what's happened. Market peaked and started its crash in 2007. It was in recovery mode until the start of 2013, then posted steady growth until 2018, this year, where if you look at the housing market, it does certainly look like it's being hit by something of a wobble. Mm-hmm. That could be the small correction. So once that passes, will we see the final leg up?
Yeah, but we're talking about 8 years' time, though, aren't we?
Well, I mean, what we could see is basically house prices stagnate or fall slightly this year and maybe next year. Mm. And then what happens is instead of seeing the big drop, they actually go up again for another 4 or 5 years to about 2025.
Yeah. When everyone realised Brexit isn't so bad.
We hit the end of the 18-year cycle and then they slump. Now, the barrier to this, I would say, is that after the 2007 peak, house prices never fell to fair value. They stopped way short of reaching their long-term relationship against wages. So they never became cheap. So maybe we've busted the boom because we didn't allow them to ever become cheap. They remained expensive through the whole, you know, fall and recovery phase and everything like that. And that actually we've corrupted the market, so we won't see that final leg up. Or On the other side of the coin, you could argue, if this Brexit stuff gets sorted, looks unlikely, doesn't it? But maybe we get a deal through. Maybe we get a bit more confidence back into it. Actually, the economy's doing all right. We've had figures this week saying that wages are going up by 3%. That's the highest wage growth in a long time. Inflation's at 2.4%. That's on the way down. We could see a period where wages consistently rise above inflation. We've got, at the moment, house prices aren't going up very quickly, so they're not going up too fast. You get a bit of confidence. Banks are lending on mortgages. The banks' finances don't look too bad now. They've kind of fixed many of the problems that they had post-financial crisis. Maybe the ingredients are there. The one thing I would warn, though, to anybody who convinces themselves based on this that we're going to see some kind of boom, is this entire theory is based on the fact that what goes up will eventually come down. Not saying I think it's correct. I'm just saying it's quite interesting. But you can prove anything with hindsight.
Absolutely. And what starts must come to an end. Thank you very much, Simon. If you have a question for the team, something you'd like us to cover, any comments on today's or previous shows, Simon?
Email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk if you've got a problem that you want us to try and solve. Tweet us at thisismoney. Come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all the podcasts past and comment on this podcast.
Indeed. And don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I. For a gift your little ones will appreciate even when they're not so little. Give them premium bonds at nsandi.com.